Massad?
My name is Massad Ayoub, and I'm here simply to tell you that gun-free zones have become hunting preserves for psychopathic murderers. And I bet there's not a one of you out there that needed a little Arab from out of town to come here and tell you. Yep, yet we live in a country that is so focused on symbolism instead of substance that they were able to sell to legislators, able to sell to the public, the childishly naive concept that if a human being who has chosen to violate the most rigidly enforced laws in the history of God and man and civilization, that somehow putting up a sign that says no guns will keep anything from happening. You know how late we're running, and I apologize to you for that, although I also fall back on the words that got me through 30 years of marriage. It's not my fault. You can't blame me. But like the other speakers, all of us here will be here afterwards for any Q&A. We're not going to sit up here and give you a litany of cases where, you know, the gun-free zone has failed and filled with the blood of the murdered innocent. We could. We don't have time, but I think you already know it. We could also stand up here and the three of us use up the entire half hour and keep going longer, giving you a litany of cases where when people like you were there when it happened, they were able to decisively stop it and drive off the wolves or put the wolves on their backs. For God's sake, it's biology 101. Predators seek prey. The creatures with fangs and claws do not prey on the other ones with fangs and claws because they know it will shorten their existence. They only fight each other over territorial imperative or mating season, neither of which generally tends to be the motivation in mass murder. This is not hypothesis. This is not our theory. This is documentable fact. How do we know it? Well, damn it, sometimes we know it because the bastards live long enough to confess to it. You want an example? 1999, 15 years ago, Los Angeles. The name Buford Furrow ring a bell with any of those of you who've studied these things? A committed white racist, a member of Aryan Nations. He said he told later in his confession, when he was asked, why did you even go to Los Angeles? He said, to kill Jews. So he decides he's going to make a list of his targets, and he very carefully scouts around. Let's see, the Skirbel Cultural Center, that looks good. Oh, but wait, there are people there who look like they might be security. What's next on my list? Oh, American Jewish University, young Jews. It'll be a gun-free zone. I'll go there, and they have security. Simon Wiesenthal, Center Museum of Tolerance. Where better could a Jew hater go and make a symbolic mass murder and, oh crap, those people are looking at me funny. They have coats. There might be guns. Until finally, he finds the North Valley Jewish Community Center, a place with his only children and some kind adults to take care of them, walks in there, ironically, with an Uzi. Semi-automatic Uzi, starts shooting. 70 shots he fires. He kills one adult, kills a teenage girl who's there helping out, and murders three little 5- and 6-year-old kids. And he flees because it's a gun-free zone. He's finally found one, and there's no one who can stop him. And when he surrenders later in Las Vegas and he's asked, okay, you made this list. Why didn't you do this one? Or this one, or this one. And his answer was, they had security. Look it up in the 1899 editions of Time and Newsweek. Don't just take the gun guy's words for it. We've all seen and heard of the tragedy July 20th, 2012, the Cinemark Century Theater in Aurora, Colorado. 12 dead, 70 wounded in that gun-free zone. And the killer, Holmes, like the coward that virtually all of them are, once he's outside the theater at his first sight of an armed man, he raises his hands and surrenders. It was our brother, our Second Amendment advocate, John Lott, who you just heard speak for the last half hour, who put together the logic there. He did the kind of research he told you he does. There had been 7 theaters within easy reach of that monster's home. There were many that were closer, and if you studied the case, you know how much heavy equipment he was carrying. It would have been much more convenient for him. But he didn't go there. There was one with way, way more people were going to be in the audience because he wanted to set his the murder record. Why did he go to the Cinemark Century? Because it was the one of the 7 that advertised itself with a sign on the door as a gun-free zone. And we saw what happened there. And in all of that, and all the blood of the innocent, and all the wrongful blame every one of you and the people you represent in this room have taken over that tragedy, everybody forgot that almost 3 months to the day before, in the same city, Aurora, Colorado, it almost happened sooner. A man drove up to the New Destiny Church, murder in his heart, a gun in his hand, started shooting. At the opening of it, he shot and killed the pastor's mother. And the opening of it was the end of it, because the New Destiny Church was not a gun-free zone. And one good man in that congregation drew his gun and shot that bastard dead before he could harm another of the 30 people he was about to have on his gun sights. Colorado again, 2007. Colorado Springs. The name Gina Sam, ring a bell with anyone in here? Raise your hand if it does. I can hear it does. Give her a hand from here. This the monster in question has already shot up and left people horizontal at another church facility. He's escaped. The word has gone out. Everybody's on the alert. This particular church is not a gun-free zone. They have people like the many of you in this audience who are volunteer security at your houses of worship. One of them is Gina Somm, former police officer, but now an ordinary armed citizen like anyone in this room with a concealed carry permit. He shows up at her church. She hears the gunfire when he begins shooting outside, literally runs to the sound of the guns. And when that creature bursts through that door with an AR-15, she's running toward him. Not just standing, running toward him with a pistol in both hands, shooting as she goes, bullet after bullet into the bastard's chest, until he's down with just enough life force left for one more pull of the trigger and he turns it on himself. And we are never going to know how many people Gina Somm saved that day, but the President of the United States himself stood up and said so. And before I turn it over to my brothers, one final word, one final invocation, if you will. December of 2012, Newtown. We all know what happened there in that gun-free zone. Little monster the night before has murdered his own mother to get at the guns. The first to die, the first of the 26, was a petite female, 47 years old, the school principal. Her name was Dawn Hochsprung. The witnesses said when he came through that door with a rifle in his hands, she ran at him like a mother wolf. They said her arms were reaching out like she was trying to take the gun, but she wasn't close enough. It was hopeless. He shot her to pieces. And we all know what happened next. 5 more adults trying to protect the children who died helpless. And those 20 murdered little kids. And 5 minutes after the first shot, when he hears the sirens and sees the patrol cars pulling up outside, only then does he put the gun to his own head. You picture that courageous young woman dying in the foyer of Sandy Hook Elementary School, and you channel back 5 years before to Gina Somm, and you ask if you could just replace. What if? What if? Thank you.
How do you follow that? My name is Johnny Dean. I'm a pediatric orthopedic surgeon, and I'm in private practice in San Antonio, Texas. Last year was my first GRPC. I was sitting out there with you. I didn't know what was going on. You know, my background wasn't in guns. I mean, I grew up in northern New Jersey. My parents were Salvation Army officers. You know, there's no guns there. You know, I've spent time in the military. I was in the Navy. I did my orthopedic training at the United States Naval Hospital in Oakland, California. I didn't get my first gun till 1992, and that was only because my racquetball partner dislocated his kneecap and took me to the range, and then there was this little thing called the L.A. riots. And that's when I bought my first gun. Fast forward to late 2012. My cousin who lives in New Jersey is looking for a gun. We're going to be going to a course in Las Vegas. And I'm helping him try to find and decide what he wants to get. And I find this thing called Gun for Hire Radio on one of the advertisements. And I listened to these two crazy guys talk about how crappy the gun laws were in New Jersey and that, you know, all the stuff that they were trying to do to fix the problem. Well, I became an NRA life member. I joined the NJ2AS, the ANJRPC, the Gun Owners of America. I became a life member of Second Amendment Foundation. I got the spirit, you know, I got the, okay. And so I listened to a few other podcasts, and there was another podcast called Armed American Radio with Mark Walters, and they were doing a concealed carry expo in Spring, Texas, which is a suburb of Houston. It's about a three-hour drive from San Antonio. I said, well, I'm going to go check this out. Besides, you know, you get to shoot guns and use somebody else's ammo, so it was a kind of a win-win. And I met Mark, and you know, I talked with Sean Young, who was his producer, and I met this other guy named Rob Pincus, and you know he had a lot of good things to say. So I said, I'm going to check this guy out. The NRA meeting was in Houston a few months later, so I said, I'm going to the NRA meeting. I'm going to check this stuff out, see what's going on. And I listened to all the folks, all the speakers, you know, the ILA speakers and the politicians and the activists, and I'm going, wow. Wow, this, I got to do something. I'm sorry, I'm blanking here a little bit. No, I'm just, I can't, let me hear. Let me go to my notes because I just forgot. So anyway,
so excellent.
Okay, I'm sorry. Good.
No, you're good.
We can fix that.
We can fix that.
Now I remember where I'm at. So while I was here, I met some people. Sada Yub I met him at the NRA meeting first with Mark, but then here in Gale, and I decided I was going to take training with those guys. I met Tim Wheeler, who's another physician, Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership, and. You know, I saw what, you know, a lot of people were doing here. I met some of my heroes, and I said, what can I do? So what I decided to do was figure out what can I do in San Antonio, my little neck of the woods in a hospital. Well, they got this problem with gun-free zones in hospitals. The statutes in Texas require hospitals and nursing homes to post the no-gun sign. And ironically, it's Texas Penal Code 30.06, which describes the sign. Somebody had a warped sense of humor. So, you know, I have a tendency to take a lot of people to the range. I do a lot of talking in the doctor's lounge. And, you know, I take training, and I've actually found a couple trainers in San Antonio that I did some training with, and I actually got them to do a course for me. So I actually put together a course for physicians, and we had a dozen people show up. Most of them were new shooters. There were some that were somewhat experienced shooters, but it was a pretty good thing. And And I said, you know, we're still not getting anywhere with this. I'm on some committees. Our committees, didn't really get anything going, even though we tried to push it. Tim helped me put together a resolution through our county medical society to try to get rid of gun-free zones in our hospitals, to go up the chain to the Texas State Medical Association. And that got voted down 22-2. Okay. In fact, one of the pediatricians that I work with stood up and said, I couldn't possibly vote for this because it goes against the American Academy of Pediatrics policy. Oh, by the way, that same guy was one of the doctors in the course a few months later because his circumstances changed. He had a stalker relative kind of a thing. So he saw the light. Okay. In July, I put together some letters, one to the CEO of the hospital and two to my state representatives. And I also put together a petition to try to get things changed. And I've got a total of 476 signatures in about 2 weeks. In the middle of that, I went off and had spent 4 days with Mass. And there was that little shooting thing in Darby, Pennsylvania that happened at the same time. So that really helped out a lot because actually people were a little bit more receptive. But in talking to people, I found out that there were probably 80% of the people were very receptive to what I had to say. In fact, a lot of them said, I'm glad you're doing this because nobody is addressing this. We have concerns about security. We can't lock the doors. If there was ever a shooter here, we're defenseless. So basically at this point, we're trying to get things going. I met a lot of resistance. Somebody called security on me one time, and the security guard asked me, would you please stop? And I said, no. I said, why? I'm not doing anything wrong. I have my identification badge. I'm on staff here. I have every right to be here. I'm talking to people that know me and, I work with every day. He goes, well, I'm going to have to go talk to the supervisor. So he steps off the ward and doesn't come back. I'm talking to the nurses for 10, 15 minutes. I finally go down to the operating room, and the nursing supervisor happened to be there. He says, oh, by the way, I talked to that security guard. And oh, by the way, I told him that I signed your thing too, and that Dr. Edeen is one of the most respected doctors on the staff at this hospital, and that you should leave him alone. Yeah. And before that, actually, after that, he came and told me he got in trouble for doing that. Okay. I got a phone call on my cell phone from the CEO of the hospital one morning asking me to cease and desist. And she says, oh, well, we have this anti-solicitation policy, and you're a doctor, and you have standing, and you're going to intimidate people and the hospital workforce environment, and they send you, registered letters that says that, you didn't do anything wrong, but we're just documenting that you did this. So they're trying to intimidate you, okay? So what I'm doing now, the next step is I actually wrote an article. I'm going to try to get it published in our County Medical Society journal. One of my patients' moms is married to a sportscaster. She has connections with the news room. She's a former police officer. So I'm going to try to use some of her connections to try to keep things going. I think, the bottom line from my standpoint where I'm going next is really to try to get support from my peers and, get a town hall meeting. So my lessons learned here is use your resources and network, talking to people. There's a lot of folks out here that I talk to. Rob Morse over here. He hooked me up with Jim Irvine. Jim Irvine gave me a lot of good information. I talked with Sean Maloney. I don't know where Sean is, but about some of the legal stuff that we had to get around. Rachel Malone, who is one of Rob's colleagues, is a Texas state activist, and I did a appleseed shoot with her. And she was the shoot boss, but also I'm going to try to utilize her for the legislative stuff. I still have to work with my state legislatures. I think that's where we got to go next. And, of course, I can't leave out Tim Wheeler, who really has been invaluable. He's actually edited my article, and he's been kind of a mentor to me as far as that's concerned. You have to be bold, but you have to be polite. You're a representative. I tend to be enthusiastic. I don't know if you can tell that or not. But sometimes I can get a little loud, and I'm kind of a big guy, so I got to kind of tone it down sometimes. But I'm not afraid to start a conversation and to try to educate people. They're going to throw roadblocks in your way. Be flexible. Take a step back. Move around and keep going. I told the CEO and the chief medical officer of the hospital at a reception for one of the administrators that was leaving, and said, look, we're going to keep having this conversation. I'm not quitting. So you might as well just accept it, And I told the CEO that I'm coming to this conference and I'm on this thing. She just shook her head. So, and oh, by the way, when all else fails, take people to the range and teach them how to shoot. And one last thing, Bob Main, one of those instructors, he's fighting cancer right now. He just had brain surgery yesterday for a recurrence of his lymphoma. And so I'd ask that you guys all say a prayer for him. And he's a great guy. He's a good friend. And I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Chris Bird. I first of all want to thank the Second Amendment Foundation for giving me the award of liberty this morning. It was totally unexpected. I mean, quite why? Why they would give that to a displaced Brit from the wrong side of the pond, I've no idea, but I hope to perhaps live up to it. We've had these problems in schools. I live about a block and a half from an elementary school in San Antonio, where, like John, I'm also from San Antonio. They have signs up, gun-free zone, drug-free zone. Well, it took me a little while, but about a week ago, I went north to a little community just north of Fort Worth on the way to Denton. It's called Argyle, and it has a school district with four schools, 2,000 students in total, so it's not very big. And I saw some signs there that were a lot better. I hope you all can read this. And yeah, I'll read it for Charles's benefit, and for those of you who can't read, I mean, because you're so far away. It says, attention, please be aware that the staff at Argyle ISD, that's Independent School District, are armed and may use whatever force is necessary to protect our students. Now, in Texas, we had in the last legislature a law that created something called a school marshal. And a school marshal is basically a teacher or staff member who's gone through a two-week training course. And I don't think this has been too successful. I asked last week for the figures, and I was told that seven people had been through this course and graduated. from five different school districts. Well, San Antonio has more than five school districts just in its immediate area. So I don't think that was too successful. And I think the reason was given to me by the chief of police at Argyle School District. When they decided to go this route, they hired a police chief and basically two volunteer officers to work after our sports events, and asked him for advice about arming teachers, because there are four schools and there's one of him, and that's not good enough. So he looked at the school martial program, and the problem with that was that the school martial program teaches that, oh yes, all the various things. However, you've got to keep that gun in a box, and you have to unlock the box when the shooter comes in the door. And that's not going to work, because part of the time, a lot of the time, you're not even going to be in the classroom. You're going to be in the restroom, you're going to be in the lunchroom, in the common room, wherever, but you're not going to be there. I'm told that there's about 40 school districts now that arm their teachers. And I went up to see the first one. This is Harold School District. It's very small. It's 200 square miles, but it doesn't have much in the way of people in it. And it has a school, one school for the district, of 125 students, and it's full. Only 15 of those students actually come from Harold School District. The others come. The superintendent, David Thwait, told me that a lot of them are coming. The parents have said, we're sending our children to your school because we feel that they're safer. And he started this after the Amish school massacre, where the Amish schoolgirls were shot and killed. And they talked about it, as I guess bureaucracies do. And then came Virginia Tech, and they said, that's it, we've got to do something. And so they started arming their teachers right after that. That was the first school district to do that in Texas. And I think it's worked out fairly well, because the superintendent tells me there are about 40 school districts now that that do that. Obviously, not many of them in the school martial program, but they can still do it on their own hook, like Argyle School District did. Now I want to tell you a little bit about a program that I was fortunate enough to watch in Ohio. You heard a little bit about this from Sean Maloney this morning, but he has been, the president of the Buckeye Firearms Association have got together with an outfit called Tactical Defense Institute, run by a guy called John Benner, and they put on a three-day program, and the Buckeye Firearms Foundation covers the cost of the tuition and also the cost of the hotel rooms that the Ohio teachers come from or come to when they're attending the course. And I was suitably impressed. I'd been to TDI before on a three-day civilians can do to cope with an active shooter. And first of all, John had some interesting information that he actually got from a policeman from Bedford, Ohio, who has a database of 150 mass shootings. And he figures that the average mass shooter is going to shoot either kill or wound 4.8 people a minute. So if your response time as a police department is 3 minutes, then you've lost a dozen people. So I guess there is a real need for teachers to have access, immediate access on their persons for guns. And slowly it's happening. I'm very encouraged about Ohio and Texas, and there are a whole bunch of other states doing the same thing. And finally, I don't fly. I've made the decision after 9/11 when I saw all the, what I call the TSA tyranny. If I can drive there, I will. And consequently, I didn't have a problem flying here. And I would recommend it to other people. It took me 2 days to drive up from Texas, but that's it. Thank you all.